The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. Annual sponsors for the City Club are Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Sue Rentz.
Well, in times of geopolitical uncertainty and challenges around the world, City Club's forum today looks at the investment environment both globally and nationally. Our discussion today will be led by Bob Maynard, the Chief Investment Officer for the Public Employee Retirement System in Idaho. In shorthand, that's PERSI, which Kevin used in his introduction. And it's one of the best performing public retirement systems in the nation, investing over $16 billion primarily for the retirement benefits of state and local government employees. Our forums are made possible with the support of our forum series sponsor, Micron, Perkins Coie, and the Echelon Group. This forum's exclusive sponsor is Bank of the Cascades. And our media sponsors are Boise State Public Radio and Peppershock Media. Our thanks to all these sponsors. Joining Bob in today's presentation are several of PERSI's investment managers who are gathered in Boise for their triennial meeting with other managers. We are pleased to have many of them attending our lunch today, and they're seated with all of our other audience guests at the tables. Hope you've had a chance to speak with them. Some of them will also be called on to answer a question or two. Audience members, please submit your questions on the cards on your tables and for the experts that we have gathered with us today. Bob, we know you all are looking at market expectations over the next 3 years, a topic of interest to everyone here, especially given that the U.S. economy has the expansion that began in 2009 has been longer than usual. Please introduce your fellow panelists, and we look forward to your investment insights.
Thank you, Sue. Hello, everyone. As Sue said, my name is Bob Maynard. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of PERSI. It's a $16.5 billion fund. Actually, as of this morning, we had all-time highs, both in terms of assets and in terms of return, although the market's down today. I just wanted to get that on the record, at least for one day. That's the case. PERSI does all of the retirement benefits. We also invest all of the funds. I'm responsible for the investment side. We have with us today as well, including our managers, our executive director, Don Drum. So is Don here at the point? I was hoping he'd be here to be able to answer any questions. If you have complaints, all complaints go to him, by the way. That's how we develop responsibilities. We also have a number of our board members here. Joy Fisher is here as a board member. She's right down here below. She's the executive director of the University of Idaho Foundation in her real life. Our director of agriculture, Celia Gould, is here, as you can see. She is a board member. Jeff Selick, I believe he may be here. I think he had another lunch today. He's with St. Luke's. And two of our board members, Jody, we are honored to have a former trustee board member, Pam Ahrens, here today. Jody Olson and Kirk Sullivan, our other two board members, had other obligations. Like I said before, we're $16.5 billion, and we're one of the best funded retirement plans not only in the nation but also the world. And that has a lot to do primarily because our political system, whatever you may think about individual policies, have been heroes with our pension fund. They have always fully funded it. They have always made sure that the benefits weren't overpromised and made sure it wasn't underdelivered, which allows us primarily to have an investment approach, which is under our mantra is simple, relatively focused, transparent, and patient. We're a conventional investor. We don't do anything tricky because we don't have to reach for returns. We try to deliver market returns on a reasonably consistent basis. That just so happens to have made us relatively high peer returns over the last couple of decades in the top quartile of all institutional investors. And as I was telling the managers this morning, now we're $16.5 billion. When I got here about 25 years ago, we were just past $2 billion. And in that period of time, we not only have, octupled, but also we have paid out $1 billion more in retirement benefits than we've taken in contributions. And that is just a testament not to any particular brilliance on our part, but just good, solid investing by good professionals in a reasonably diversified manner. And so in that regard, once every 3 years, we pull together all of our managers, not only bond and fixed income, but private equity and real estate, just to get together, one, to make sure that everyone understands what we're trying to do and what they're doing on our behalf, but also to give exchange of views on the markets ahead and any factors that we think should be watched extra carefully. That's what this two-day conference is about. We also have some entertaining things like talking about Amazon as a disruptor and other sorts of activities. And one of the activities we have done as a tradition for the new millennium or the new century or both is that we have once every 3 years done a City Club lunch like this one. And now this is the 15th year, and we did the first one in 2002. I think actually it may be our sixth. And now, 15 years later, I think I can tell you why we did the first City Club lunch. At that time, another board member of ours, Marilyn Schuler, and myself were on the City Club board. At that time, the finances were starting to be going into a tumble. And I was on the finance committee. Marilyn is on the executive committee. And at that time, I don't know if you still use this particular approach, but we broke the budget down into two basic sections, basically with the principle that a membership dues paid for organizational expenses, and each forum had to pay for itself, either through sponsorships or whatever. And so we decided we're bringing in all these managers from across the world. Make them pay for lunch in a paying forum. So we did this. We had a special forum, and I have to admit, at the time, we charged the managers a trifle more than the average membership. I hope that doesn't come back to haunt us. But anyway, everybody had such a good time at that forum that even now that the City Club is on firm footing, we have done this once every 5 years, 3 years. And that because the managers enjoy interacting with the community, and we have found that, at least in the past, it may stop this time, that the community has enjoyed interacting with us because we're not just we're a state organization, not just for the retirees. We also like to give back to the community to the extent that we can. What we intend to do here is what we've done in the past. About half the time available, we're going to have about four presentations of 5 to 10 minutes each. On particular topics, and then we're going to take questions from the audience. When we get questions from the audience, I'm going to bounce it back to managers in the audience who are probably best able at that point to answer that question specifically. And so please write your questions on any topic, and if it's complaints, I'll be glad to forward it on to Don Drum when I find him again at that time. Our initial speakers will be John Bowman from WAMCO. He was going to be giving a overview of the basic debt and money markets, basic debt and monetary policy, the Fed, things of that nature, worldwide. He's from the Western Asset Management, and he was formerly deputy undersecretary, is a chief right-hand person for Tim Geithner at Treasury during the crisis. crisis. So if you have crisis questions, not only will they go to Don, they'll go, I'm going to give them to John. Henry Diario, you've seen before. He is a portfolio manager at Bernstein. He's responsible primarily for our emerging markets portfolio, but also works on one of our global equity portfolios. And he has spoken before City Club. They're both going to take 10 minutes. He's going to, Henry's going to talk about the world equity markets and major issues there. After those two, we have two five-minute real estate presentations. One will be from Mike Byrne, AEW, who is primarily in charge of our real estate portfolio, our private real estate portfolio. And then you'll hear from Brandon Fitzpatrick. We have a half a billion dollar local Idaho commercial mortgage program that he's in charge with, and he'll give his preliminary views on the Idaho real estate market. So that'll take up about 30 minutes. And then we'll go to questions. But first, John, all yours.
Okay, great. You know, let me just start by saying thanks for lunch and the opportunity to speak with you. I appreciate it, including the two representatives of Cascade Banks or Bank of the Cascades at the table back there. Appreciate the conversation and buying me lunch, or maybe I bought lunch. I don't know. Either way, I appreciate it, and I enjoyed that. Yep, good. So I just wanted to make a few quick points. Before I do that, let me just kind of set the stage a little bit. You know, as was mentioned, we're a fixed income only firm. There's this perception out there that the bond guys are kind of the Eeyores of the financial markets. They're always kind of dark. They always want to, you know, stuff could go wrong. You should own bonds. That's the perception. I'm going to try and change that a little bit. I'm actually a little bit more optimistic and have a little bit more rosy take on the world. So I just want to put that in your head, and we'll see if I accomplish that. The two things I wanted to talk about, I just wanted to make two points. The first point is there a need for monetary policy tightening right now? And by monetary policy tightening, I mean, do policymakers at the Fed, at other central banks, need to do something to correct what's going on in the economy? I think that's actually an open question. This is something you hear a lot of debate about. I'm going to tell you my view, but I think that's probably, you know, one of the most important questions that we're getting. So that's the first question. And the second question I want to talk about is the Federal Reserve is raising rates. They've raised rates now three times. They raised rates again yesterday. And the question is, does that matter? You know, certainly if you're reading the Wall Street Journal or watching CNBC, God forbid, you think it matters a lot. I'm going to challenge that a little bit. It's not actually clear to me that matters very much. So those are my two questions. Is there a need for the Fed or any other central bank in the world right now to correct something, to tighten policy? And the Fed's raising rates. Is that a problem? So let me start with that first question. Is there a need for monetary policy to be tighter or be different? You know, you hear a lot of people out there arguing for yes. The arguments they make include the unemployment rate's fallen a lot. We've gone a long ways into this recovery. The recovery by some measures is now the second longest recovery that we've had since we started measuring recoveries. That seems like a long time. Bond yields are still quite low. Some would argue equity prices are high. You're familiar with all these arguments, and some people look at that combination of factors and say, yes, monetary policy needs to change. We need to have higher rates here in the United States. So I'd say that argument's out there. We're on the other side. We actually don't think you need tighter monetary policy right now. And the reason is we just don't think inflation is much of a constraint. And when you think about the problem facing monetary policymakers, the Federal Reserve, really any policymaker around the world, their objective is pretty straightforward. Maximize growth, get incomes up, get growth going, subject to the constraint of inflation not being a problem. So you don't want growth going so fast that you're creating inflation, because then that actually ends up causing distortions and affecting behavior that ends up being self-defeating. But if inflation's not a problem, if inflation's not a constraint, then there's nothing preventing policymakers from pursuing head-on a growth strategy. And I actually think that's where we are today. You know, growth has been, it's been positive for a number of years. It hasn't been very fast. We could still go a long ways yet. And as long as inflation is not a problem, I think policymakers around the world are going to continue to pursue growth-oriented strategies. So again, from our perspective, is there a need for them to tighten policy right now? Our answer is, as long as inflation is not a threat, the answer is no. There is no reason for the Federal Reserve or anybody else to seek tighter monetary conditions. And again, the one kind of message I have here is when you're thinking about what the Fed's doing, they're not looking at the months of the recovery. They're looking at the unemployment rate, but not very carefully. They're looking at, how do I maximize growth? subject to my inflation constraint. If the inflation constraint is not operative, they're going to keep maximizing growth. So that's kind of the first question. Now, in the second question, okay, so the Fed's raising rates. They did it again yesterday. They've done it, you know, now four times. They're probably going to keep going. Does this matter? Now, again, if you read the newspaper or you watch TV, it's good. Yeah, of course this matters. This is what people like me are paid to do, is care about this type of thing. But from a broader perspective, it's not really clear that it's having much of an impact. Since the Fed started raising interest rates again in December, we've actually seen the dollar move lower. Interest rates, the 10-year yield, 30-year yields have moved lower. The equity market has moved up, and growth is actually a little bit better. So if I didn't tell you what the Fed was doing and just told you that bond prices are higher, yields are lower, equity prices higher, the dollar lower, and growth is continuing, you would guess that the Fed is still on the sidelines, or maybe even that they're easing. The point here being that there is no mechanical relationship between what the Fed's doing in the interest rate meetings and what's actually happening in the broader markets. The context matters a huge amount. And in this case, the context is way more important than whatever the Fed's doing. And the context recently has been fairly positive. Growth's a little bit better. Risk-taking's a little bit better. Banks are starting to do a little bit more lending and activity. We were talking about kind of the regulatory landscape at my table earlier. The regulatory landscape is loosening a little bit. That's going to help risk-taking sentiment. That's going to help banks. This is all providing a very benign, very positive context. And in that context, what the Fed's doing is really very second order. So I'm going to stop. I could go on for a while, but let me just kind of reiterate. You know, from our perspective as the bond guys, I think inflation's low to not a problem. That makes me bullish on the bond market. Maybe that makes me an Eeyore, but I actually don't think so, because I think what's going on right now is low inflation creates an environment where central banks around the world can pursue growth-oriented strategies without being disruptive. And I think that ultimately could be good for all asset classes, frankly. Stop there.
He's right. That's the most cheerful bond presentation you'll ever have. And I think in order to get depressed again, we should call in an equity guy. No, Henry Diaria, I've been trying for almost 20 years now to call him Hank. It hasn't taken yet. So, but Henry, he's our, like I said, our global. He'll give you the equity overview of the world. And Mike Byrne and Brandon, can you come on up here to be the next speakers after we get done with Henry? Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I should be more prepared for that introduction. I have been threatened to be called Hank by Bob more than once. So in that context of the scenario John just laid out of modest inflation, interest rates that are sanguine, maybe they go up, but they don't go up by a lot. I think the bottom line would be that's a good environment for continued equity price growth, particularly given that that backdrop of rising interest rates would suggest that that's because economic growth is reasonable. Therefore, corporate earnings growth would be reasonable. And so then as you go around the world, I think some of the discussions start to be where are stocks more interestingly priced than in others. In the U.S., right, since we went into our recession we responded with easing quick. We've been coming out of that recession quicker than other parts of the world. But Europe and Japan and now EM have started to rebound as well. So we're in a point in the cycle where while U.S. corporate earnings continue to grow, we're starting to see faster growth rates in earnings outside the United States. So, for example, in Europe, in Japan, in emerging in aggregate, the estimates are for growth rates in the mid-teens this year, a slightly slower growth rate here in the United States, but growth nonetheless. The big difference is the starting valuation of stocks, right? In the U.S., PEs, price-to-earnings ratio, is about 18%. Outside the United States, significantly lower. In emerging markets, something only in the range of 13 times earnings. And so I think a growing group of investors start to say with Faster earnings growth now outside the United States, with the dollar having rebounded fairly strongly over the last few years, and therefore some non-U.S. Currencies looking more attractive, a rotation towards these non-U.S. Markets. And emerging, in particular, has started to do better. And that's a big area of my focus. Among those emerging is that little country, China, where the list of concerns is long, right? This growth in the amount of debt that they have, how can they absorb higher commodity prices? What about some of the speak that comes out of the United States government about trade and trade restrictions? You might think that Chinese stocks are having a tough time. The emerging index generally is up 18% this year versus about 8% for the U.S. S&P 500. The stock market that has done the best in emerging markets is China. Right, it's up about 24% year to date. And a lot of that has to do with some of the Chinese technology stocks, like an Alibaba or a Tencent. But I think more broadly, it has to do with global economies continuing to recover, that some of the risks around an export-driven Asia start to decline. And PE revaluation is a lot about beliefs that the risks around stocks have stopped getting worse in some of these more cyclically sensitive parts of the world. And I'll leave you with one other thought with regard to China before we shift to the other speakers. I will say that in 10 years from now, which would be three lunches, we could... we might be talking about an environment where plans like Percy are talking about hiring a China equities manager, right? Because June 20th, right, this month, the MSCI, which is the big provider of indexes for the equity markets, they'll make an announcement about whether the local China A-share market will start to be included in this benchmark that foreign managers are judged against. And my prediction is that they will add China A-shares. They will add them at a small weight. They'll be roughly 50 basis points of the emerging markets index. And that is meant by MSCI as a signal on the direction that you're heading. And when you think about that direction, as that Chinese stock market becomes available to more foreigners, you could see the portion of China within that emerging bench rise from the roughly 25% that it makes up today to 35 or 40%. And I think at that point, many investors will start to say, well, I'm going to hire someone who specializes in this next big equity market, and they'll start to separate that out of their emerging market part of their portfolio. So let me pause there, and we'll take questions later, but thank you very much.
By the way, Henry, I'll make you a bet on this month, and you're all here witness to it. I bet they won't add it. That it's a dinner and a reasonable bottle of wine at the next time we're in the same city together. There's real issues with the A-share market opening up. We may talk about that.
We agree that that dinner is in New York City. The odds of this guy actually getting to New York City is about zero.
Yeah, pretty close. Pretty close. Yeah, I have two rules of travel. Never leave before 9 a.m. and don't travel east of the Rockies unless there's a gun to your head, literally or figuratively. It's not worth it. Sorry, A side issue, by the way. I apologize for the next thing we're going to talk about here is the real estate market, because with the declining interest rates, there have been declining cap rates, and real estate values have – and real estate has done very, very well over the last few years. The question is, in the context of widely expected rising interest rates and others – what's that going to do for the private real estate market? Or the and we have two real estate portfolios that are private. One is held by AEW, that is our primary equity real estate, located worldwide. And we also have a local Idaho commercial mortgage program, like I said before, that we directly own and service, of about half a billion, with Brandon. And he will give you the Idaho context of the real estate market. So, Mike, do you want to lead off with the national scene for about 5 to 6 minutes, and then we can turn it over to Brandon. So come on up.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me today. I am thankful that all I need to do every day is wake up and thinking about good old-fashioned supply and demand when it comes to real estate, because these guys make my head spin. But I thought today I'd just talk about sort of three topics in the real estate space. One, I'll just talk about where the property fundamentals are today, and maybe make a few observations around some things that we're not seeing that we might expect to see at this point in the property market cycle. Talk a little bit about valuations and where they are today, and then maybe a quick comment about return expectations and performance going forward, to Bob's point. So generally, that's right. That's right. It's part of the job description. Yep. So property market fundamentals today are really strong. We say and we think that real estate is a late cycle asset class. We're 8 or 9 years into an expansion here, so we've had a lot of room to run. And what comes with that expansion is the time for property markets to benefit from job growth, benefit from improve local property market fundamentals, and gain occupancy, right? So when markets gain occupancy, you have the opportunity to improve asset level performance by increasing rents. And almost without exception, all property markets today are at historic peak occupancies and at historic peak rents. So we're in a place in the cycle now where our properties are we call it the peak of the NOI cycle. We are we're sort of clicking on all cylinders, right? But what does that mean for each individual asset class? We think about things in terms of product type as well as regional consideration. But for today, we'll talk about property type. Start with multifamily, right? Multifamily today, if you look out the window, if you drive around, you'll see cranes everywhere, right? There's clearly a supply threat to multifamily today that exists maybe in a more severe way than it does to other product types. Multifamily, specifically in urban areas where real estate developers and capital allocators like ourselves have witnessed the best demand growth over the last several years, are at risk now for oversupplying those markets. And we're also underwriting these buildings to rents that are really difficult to forecast a meaningful rent growth off of, because there's definitely an affordability issue when it comes to housing today. That said, I still don't think we're building enough housing in this country generally. Part of that is the lack of single-family homes that have been built since the financial crisis. And so we think there's an opportunity today to buy more housing and try to buy housing that's more appropriate for middle incomes. So the multifamily space today, in spite of where fundamentals are, and in spite of the fact that we're late in an economic expansion here, feels like a decent bet to us. On the office side, it's a little bit more complicated. With unemployment at like 4%, college-educated unemployment rates like 2.5%, it's hard for us to imagine or conceive of a way where we can generate enough more jobs to create more demand for office space. So office is an asset class that we're worried about over the near term, and we expect some moderating demand and perhaps some opportunity for underperformance going forward. The retail space is, I think, what gets the most headlines today. We talked yesterday about the threat of e-commerce to traditional retail, and that threat is very real. There are also a lot of other threats that exist in the retail space that don't get the headlines. Growing wage income inequality, the lack of real wage growth that exists in this country and has for decades for the majority of the population, changing consumer preferences, right? We've got an aging millennial demographic that's aged out of that teen apparel, category, and they're looking for something else. A lot of the losers you see today in the retail market, those tenants are the ones that haven't aged with their demographic appropriately. So retail has a lot of headwinds that we're very cognizant about and worried about today. The darling in the real estate world today is industrial space. A lot of the demand that you see moving away from traditional retail is moving into warehouses as the consumer continues to buy their product online. That comes from the warehouses. So we're very bullish on warehouses, more so than we are the other product types today. In terms of valuations today, cap rates, which is how we measure valuations in real estate, it's basically the income stream you get from rents off a property divided by your purchase price or your valuation, they're at all-time lows. So an average cap rate today in the real estate market is about 4.5%. That is based off of a spread to the U.S. Treasury, which is in line with historical averages, but with little room for error. With 4% yields, the real estate space is incredibly exposed to potential rise in interest rates, and so we think about that all the time. That said, what we've benefited from in the last several years in real estate is since the financial crisis, returns have been really outstanding. You know, core property real estate has generated somewhere between a 12 and 15% annual return in the real estate space. That opportunity is moderating as the prospect for continued capital appreciation is clearly slowing off of those low yields. And it's really just about generating income at your property level. So with growth slowing and with capital appreciation sort of wrung out today, the forward-looking expectation for real estate returns is far, far lower than it has been over the last several years. I think the way we think about real estate and its opportunity for performance is really relative to stocks and bonds. You know, if growth accelerates from here, I think you can all expect that real estate will probably underperform the equities market, the S&P, and maybe it'll outperform bonds. If growth goes the other way and it starts to slow more dramatically, I think you can expect to see real estate maybe outperform the equity markets and underperform bonds. So that's our view of the world, and be happy to take questions later. Gotta go.
And as the final introductory talk before we take questions, Brandon Fitzpatrick of DBF and Company, they've been running our Idaho commercial mortgage program since the 80s. And it's something we're very proud of. And like I say, we have about $500 million in the program, and we hope it continues to grow. So, Brandon, you want to give your view of the local Idaho real estate market from the perspective that you see it?
Well, thank you, Bob. Mike did a good job of talking about a lot of the macro issues in real estate. I'm going to try to bring it down to the micro here in the local market in Idaho. There have been three main factors that have created this real bull market in commercial real estate in Idaho specifically. Number one, economic growth. The macro economy has been growing, but the economy in Idaho has been growing very well too. Unemployment is down across the state. Statewide unemployment is down to, last I saw, was 3.4%. Housing market, as we all know, is very hot. I keep hearing about smaller tech firms that are moving into Boise. That's probably not a major factor yet, but it's somewhat of a factor. And there's also been a lot of in-migration, let's call it, or people moving into Idaho from other parts of the country. Some of them are looking for jobs. Others are looking for a place to retire. They like the quality of life, and they like the low cost of living. So all of that has been a major factor that's helped commercial real estate. As Mike was talking about too, another really critical factor to keep in mind is low interest rates. So low interest rates help commercial real estate in two ways. Number one, they make asset managers look for places to deploy their money where they can get more return, because fixed income and maybe the equity markets are already pretty high. So that makes commercial real estate more attractive. Another factor too is financing is a critical part of commercial real estate. And as interest rates are low, you get this search for yield, and then lenders are more likely to take more risks and to lend on commercial real estate. That also provides fuel for the commercial real estate market. So all of those have really come together. And then the final factor for Idaho specifically is there have really been big price appreciations in what they call the tier one markets across the country. So we're talking Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, and all these places. And a big factor there is there's a lot of foreign money moving into these places because the foreigners really like, now I'm speaking generally, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. The foreigners really like the big name places. So they like to be in downtown San Francisco and Seattle. So a lot of the local domestic investors are selling out of those places and moving their money into more secondary markets, such as Idaho. So that's been a factor that's been going on for the last few years. And all of this has come together to have prices go up really high, profitability is up, and hence we see construction in downtown Boise. So as Mike was talking about sectors specifically, that what he said was really apt for Idaho as well. Multifamily's been very good. Hotels have also been, I know the profitability in hotels has been very high. And so that's been a good sector. Office, there's been construction downtown. Office has been doing well. Also industrials, you know, industrials have been doing well in the local market. The one area, as Mike said, that faces headwinds is retail, especially in the bigger box. They call them mid-box and big-box stores. So we're talking the tenants would be Kmart or Sears or these malls. We had a big discussion yesterday in the conference about Amazon and all the technological change that has occurred and is occurring. It's probably not a good future for some of these bigger retail spaces. Smaller retail, if it's well-positioned, we have in the local market, we haven't really seen a lot of strain there. But in the bigger boxes, we have seen it. So I'm going to keep it very brief. What does the future hold? I think that the move from the primary markets to the secondary markets is very likely to continue for some time. How long? We'll have to see. Idaho, I think the long-term potential for growth and for commercial real estate is very high, very good. I think population is going to continue to grow. Short-term, there's not a lot that scares me. I think that the things that have helped real estate are likely to continue. The risk is maybe more in the middle because there's always the chance that people can overproduce the profit. They see the profitability. They make mistakes. They build too much. We haven't really seen it yet. But you know, if we were to see a bunch more hotels go down in downtown Boise, that would be a worry for me. And then finally, interest rates generally. If interest rates were to go up, that we saw a little bit of that earlier in the year when interest rates went up after the election, we saw a real pause in activity in commercial real estate. So, but I think it would have to go up significantly from here. But if it did, that would be a headwind. And with that, I'll stop.
Thanks, Fred.
I'd like to introduce, by the way, we're a lean shop at Percy. It's Rochelle and myself, which basically means Rochelle does all the work, and she's going to be doing all the work on answering the questions. When we get questions, I'm going to ask her to figure out which manager is probably best to take the answer. So this is an interesting one for our currency and fixed income people. Could you share your views on the cryptocurrency, bitcoins, similar sort of non-traditional trade items, and as to whether or not that's going to have any impact over the reasonable future in terms of trade, in terms of, and you can also include whether or not the use of blockchain techniques for settling trades. So could someone answer that? Constantine is with Pareto. We have a currency manager on standby in case we need one. So, Constantine, will you take that?
Yeah, so we tend to look at G10 currencies, things like dollar, euro, dollar, yen, things like that. Dollar Bitcoin is not one of the ones we follow as of yet. I think this is more of a technology question. So I would say that you need three things from any currency. You need medium of exchange, you need a store of value, and you need these kind of qualities. Now, Bitcoin is not widely accepted around the world. So as a medium of exchange, it's not there yet. Yes, store of value, it's not widely accepted. You don't sort of store your wealth in Bitcoin yet. I think it has some interesting qualities. The blockchain as an accounting measure is very interesting. Do I own it? No, But then again, I'm a bit conservative. I don't even have a mobile phone. So if anybody from the technology space wants to comment on this, please be my guest.
All right. The next question would either be Mike Torres and Mike Byrne, if you want to give it. And that is, with regard to commercial real estate, do you see, given the fact that a lot of people, and we as we're talking, those big box stores and malls, and you see empty stores like the old Kmart stores and over in Park Center, do you see the real estate industry being able to repurpose that space effectively, either into community centers or other reasons? We did have a discussion on that, and I'd like both Mike and both Mikes to answer. One will be Mike Torres, who runs our REIT portfolio.
Sure, Bob. Thank you. Thank you. There's definitely higher and best use for the real estate. Some of the locations are actually quite good. The transition is going to take years, I think, is the biggest problem, mainly because of scraping those assets, building codes, and then getting the capital. But I do think there's higher and better use for a lot of the real estate sites.
Okay. Such as, what would they be, what do you see them doing now?
I think, as Mike Byrne pointed out, we do have a housing shortage, so we'll get more probably mixed-use housing, some modest retail, and some office use.
All right, we're going to move into the dreaded Trump question, which is, what are the likely effects of the market of the political instability that is occurring since the incoming Trump administration? Who's going to be brave enough to end? Also, there's a secondary question. Is there consensus in our industry regarding federal regulations as to whether they're necessary, whether they're burdensome, whether they're or whether they're effective? I wouldn't mind John leaping in on the last question. And as we're finding someone willing to take the Trump, I will say the following with regard to that from our perspective. A lot of what you're seeing right now is outside of the capital market issues. From the standpoint, the fluff and furry, whatever you may think about it, at worst, what it's going to occur with regard to all of the things that might affect the economy later on, whether it is on the immigration, whether it's on trade, whether it's on infrastructure, whether it's on deregulation, which in many respects, most of that is seen as positive for the it's going to be gridlock. And it's always been our view, much in the 80s and 90s, where greed was good, it's always been our view that gridlock actually isn't that bad, is good, as long as it isn't something where something really stupid is done, like defaulting on our debt. That sort of stuff, but for the most part, I think everybody across the spectrum say shouldn't be done. It may occur by a problem. But absent those sorts of those outside the core, what you're going to get is what you're seeing now, and right now what you're seeing now is adequate growth. Now, that could change 3 to 4 years from now, but it's going to be taking a while. One of the issues we had in putting together this conference is that we thought that by now you would see a relatively clear direction on a number of economic policies, not only here, but overseas with Brexit, with the Chinese leadership conference, with the Korean Peninsula. We'd see a lot more definition. So far, we haven't got it, so it's almost too early to tell. But even without that, you're seeing relatively coordinated global growth and things of that nature. But John is a much better position on the federal regulations, and I'm going to want to have another manager volunteer to see whether or not they think the political instability, which may have a long-term impact on market considerations. So, John?
You know, maybe actually if I could venture into the political question, I'll be so brave.
Please, yeah.
You know, I think that view that you just expressed, that the distractions, whether that's the FBI or whether that's whatever it is, have created gridlock, I think that's largely understood, if not the consensus. And the only thing I'd say in response is you have to be aware of low expectations. And I think right now expectations are very low that anything gets done. And what that means is we could actually be surprised positively if they do manage to do something on taxes or on infrastructure given how low expectations are, I think people would be pleasantly surprised at this point, and that could end up being a pretty positive thing. So, you know, I agree that the base case is probably gridlock and probably nothing happens, but expectations are pretty low. And, you know, when expectations are this low, they can be surprised. You know, on regulation, you know, we were talking about this a little bit at lunch earlier. I do think there is a case to be made that the financial regulation maybe has been a little bit too tight. I certainly wouldn't argue, and I think most people wouldn't argue that means we should have no regulation, but I do think there's an argument for dialing that back a little bit, and I think that's happening. And, you know, for all the challenges in passing things out of the Senate and the House, some of that, and if not a large part of that deregulation, can happen without the congressional process, and, you know, that's one thing that we expect to move forward. So, again, two messages. I think expectations are pretty low at the moment for positive things to happen. That's probably right, but, you know, if positive things do happen, we could be pleasantly surprised. And then, you know, the financial deregulation, it's not going all the way to deregulation, but I think the dials will be changed a little bit, and that's another positive.
Any other manager wanting to step up? If you don't step up now, you're going to pay for it this afternoon when you have to. Over here. Here we go. Henry. And actually, if you could also talk about the political uncertainty with Brexit as well, given the fact that Theresa May just had her head handed to her.
Well, where I was going to go, and maybe I can avoid that second question, there can still be the gridlock executive legislature and within the legislature. But there are lots of things the executive can do on his own. And one of the common risks that we've discussed during this conference is the inflation scenario gets more tricky if trade flows change and cause trade barriers to go into place that causes the cost of goods for everyone in the world to go higher. And so we haven't really seen him take many actions other than to talk about steel into the United States being benefited. But that type of executive order plays right to his need to firm up his base, right, which is to protect high-paying jobs in industries like steel or in autos, which is how you've seen the capital markets react, is on the same day that he announced protection for U.S. steel, U.S. auto stocks went up just as much as the steel stocks, which seems perverse given that the steel goes into autos. But investors are saying if this is the path we're going to protect some industries, then autos would be the next. And Brexit sort of plays into this common theme of these policies that people are debating are meant to protect the parts of the population that haven't participated in the economic growth.
Bill Palumbo is willing to, where is he? Right back there. Right. Bill Palumbo with Mountain Pacific.
Hi, everyone. I'm Bill Palumbo from Mountain Pacific, local advisor. As far as political instability in the stock market, I'd point out that in 2015, there was an earnings recession where corporate earnings actually declined and the stock market didn't do very well, even though we were in a politically stable environment. So I think the stock market is more concerned about corporate earnings growth than it is about the political environment. And right now, corporate earnings are growing again. Corporate earnings actually bottomed in the middle of 2016 and started to grow again in 2017. And right now, corporate earnings are looking pretty good. And so that's what the market really focuses on more than the political environment. So if you asked me to choose between corporate earnings growth and some political instability or a politically stable environment and poor earnings growth, I would definitely choose to where we are right now rather than in 2015.
And Bill, you might as well answer a follow-up question we got. Is there going to be a stock market correction in the near future? See, but that doesn't go for me because I'm a long-term investor, except for June 30th of this year when we lock in our fiscal year returns. then I turn back to a long-term investor. So
I hope we're safe for the next 2 weeks. Perzi's fiscal year is June 30th. That's Bob's concern. The stock market hasn't corrected. It hasn't had a significant correction for quite a while. So it certainly is vulnerable to having one. And it could happen at any time. But if it does happen, I think it will be just that, a correction. I think the bull market that we're in is still intact. And a correction would actually, a 5 to 10% correction, would actually be healthy for the bull market that we're in the middle of right now.
Anybody else want to take that stock market correction question? All right. Another one is the national debt a red herring? I wouldn't mind Jack from IRNM answering that question. John can leap in. Don Smith, I believe you have a view on that. And we have Mike with IRNM, one of our bond managers out of Boston.
I think there's a political question there that's been addressed already, and it's a question of how much is going to happen in the administration. Are we going to have infrastructure spending? Are we going to have tax cuts? And if all that happens, I do think it's likely that the budget deficit becomes a problem again.
And how does it become a problem? What's the impact of a budget deficit, a high national debt, particularly if interest rates continue to be low? And it's kind of like oftentimes it's compared to the idea that, yeah, your personal debt may be high, but if your monthly debt payments are low, it's not that big a problem.
So it can be a problem on a number of fronts. Obviously, if the budget deficit is going to grow, it means that revenues are below spending. And we have to finance that. And just like we have compound interest in our savings accounts, the government basically has to keep paying interest on the interest. So it becomes a compounding issue, which requires more debt to be sold. And when there's more supply of debt, there's a chance that the rates on that debt have to go up. So while rates are low now, I think there's a risk that it would start to force rates up and crowd out private borrowing and potentially slow the economy.
You know, when I think about, or when I get the question about the national debt, I think it's really important to remember that what we're talking about is we're talking about a ratio of debt to income. So just to pick up on Bob's analogy there, is for a household, you don't just think about your stock of debt, you think about your stock of debt relative to your income. And policymakers are in kind of this unique place where you can either focus on the numerator, you can focus on getting debt down, or you can focus on the denominator to get income up. And I think most policymakers, given the choice, will obviously choose to get income up, like a household. You know, if I give you the choice of restructuring your debt or having more income, they're all going to choose to have more income. And I actually think that's, you know, it may sound like kind of the callous political argument, but that's actually the right economics too, for the reason of the miracle of compound interest. If I can get my income up a little bit over a 30 or 40 or 50 year period, that makes a huge difference. So the thing that I worry about is not so much the numerator there, not so much the amount of debt, but the income. And I think as long as we can keep income up, you know, that's gonna solve a lot of problems. So the thing I would focus on is the denominator in that ratio. I think that's the right politics, but I think that's also the right economics.
I was going to have Don Smith answer that.
Okay.
Go ahead. And Don also answered the question about a stock market correction. And if you were an individual investor, what would you do in the stock market? That, which is another question we have.
If I were a what?
An individual investor and didn't have access. And by the way, we got the question, are our managers Percy employees? They are not. They are compensated on a percentage of the amount under investment. It's in basis points. By the way, our overall expenses are around 27 basis points, and we're in the lower 10th or third of institutional investors. The average expense ratio is around 62. So they're not being, at this point, overpaid. And in fact, they're willing to pay us money what they lose money. So we've
always appreciated that.
Don, go ahead.
Okay, so debt as a percent of GDP has been growing in every country pretty much. A consumer in the United States has paid off some debt. It's not as leveraged as it used to be, but that's offset by government debt going up worldwide. tremendously. And there's a perfect correlation. The higher the debt to GDP, actually the slower the growth rate in the future. So it doesn't bode well. In short, every country is over-leveraged, in my opinion, and it's a real problem for growth going forward, and also exerts deflationary force on the economy. Now, what concerns me more is all the money printing that governments have done worldwide. The United States now has a balance sheet of $4 trillion in the Federal Reserve. Worldwide, it's over $10 trillion. And believe me, this is just money printed out of thin air. And if you and I were to do this, we'd go to jail for counterfeiting money. And the Federal Reserves worldwide are on the same path because they all went to the same school and studied under the same professors. And it's really concerning because we're all following the same path. And if it doesn't work, you know, it's not going to just be the U.S. going in a recession or depression. It's going to be worldwide. And recently the Fed raised rates. I have been arguing for a long time they should be sell off their bond portfolio. And that would raise rates automatically. But to raise short-term rates and sit there with a $4 trillion bond portfolio doesn't make any sense to me. So the next question is, what do you do if you're an individual investor? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
What would you do? By the way, I called on Don specifically because Don is a bond guy in equity clothing, whereas John is an equity guy in bond clothing. So I wanted to make sure you knew we weren't all of a similar viewpoint and approach.
Oh, the other point I'd make, though, is financial assets are an all-time high versus real assets. So if you believe that that will reverse at some point, you want to be in real assets, I guess. I mean, one of our large positions is gold stocks, not gold itself, but the stocks. And I think that some of these stocks are down 80-90% from their high in 2011. And if they went back to where they were, it'd be up 3-4 times. So if I were an individual investor, cash, gold stocks, and pray.
And actually, as a final comment on this, I'd like Gary from Peregrine, who is our large cap growth manager out of Minneapolis, to also talk about the U.S. stock market. Is there a near-term correction? And if you were an individual investor, what would you do?
Well, Gary Nussbaum from Peregrine Capital Management. I'm probably a little bit more on the other side relative to Don. We're growth managers. So we look for earnings growth on a global basis. And
you can tell Don's a value manager and more on the pessimistic side. Gary's a growth manager. I want a little bit of optimism at the end.
Yeah. So what we're seeing today is pretty Goldilocks type of an environment where it's good economic growth, slow, and fairly good earnings growth, which has been the driver of the stock market. So given where the inflation is, given where the global economies are, the stock market is not much overvalued relative to what we see anyway. So we would expect returns to be more in line in the future with underlying earnings growth, which we would expect to be 6-7%. You add on a dividend over time and over a long period of time, and I'm talking 5-10, maybe even longer time frames, that you can see pretty good returns in the U.S. stock market and, as Henry pointed out, in global markets as well.
All right. Thank you. With that, we're going to have to shut it down, and I'll give it back to Kevin. There were a number of questions for me. I didn't take them only because I wanted to get our manager some airtime. If you ever want to form, I'll be glad to answer them individually or privately. If you see me on the street and I'm cheap, just buy me a cup of coffee, and the problem won't be getting me to talk, but getting me to shut up. So, Kevin, it's all yours.
So for our radio audience, you've been listening to a City Club of Boise forum featuring Bob Maynard and the folks at Percy talking about the capital markets. That's a wrap for today. I want to thank Bob and his crew for taking their time and sharing their expertise with us. And with that, we're adjourned.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a nonpartisan forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.